This podcast of Bookworm is a production of KCRW Santa Monica at 89.9 FM and webcasting at kcrw.com.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today I'm happy to have as my guest Kazuo Ishiguro, whose sixth novel, Never Let Me Go, has recently been published by Knopf. The first five books, including several favorite books of mine, are A Pale View of Hills, An Artist of the Floating World, The Remains of the Day, The Unconsoled, and When We Were Orphans. Now, it seems to me that The Unconsoled was a huge breakthrough novel, or at least it was for me. Its strangeness seemed to be enormously enunciative. And the two novels that follow it seem almost as if they are made way for by the authoritative strangenesses of The Unconsoled.
Yeah, you could say that. I mean, looking back, I do feel that without The Unconsoled, you know, my career as a writer would have gone in a different direction altogether. It's not so much that this current book, the latest book and the one before, are extensions of what I was doing in The Unconsoled. But I think those last two books have been written in the knowledge that, you know, if I wanted to, there are these things that I can fall back on. There's a certain territory I can have access to as and when I need them. So I think both When We Were Orphans and Never Let Me Go, they are kind of quasi-realist novels. You know, you can almost read them as straightforward novels or you know, give or take some genre concessions if you want. But I think they often edge off of the normal territory. And I think I've kind of given myself permission to do that because I spent so much time during The Unconsoled occupying this utterly different territory. But I feel whatever project I started with The Unconsoled, I haven't completed yet.
It's interesting because there, the originality seems such and caused such dismay among readers who are now rapidly retracing their steps and saying, no, I always liked it, I always liked it. But it's as if the books that followed, their strangenesses were given allowances by having, say, the key signature in When We Were Orphans of detection and mystery, and here in the new book, Never Let Me Go, of dystopian science fiction. So however strange things become, there's something to fall back on for the reader who doesn't have to be as suspended in the unknown as he was in The Unconsoled.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, at that level, these are both of these books aren't difficult books for a reader to negotiate. By and large, I'm using traditional methods in these books, I would say. Just at the edges, I think I take the license to trim little pieces of the natural world when it suits me to do that. Whereas The Unconsoled seems to take place in a completely different world with different behavioral rules and sometimes different physical rules as well. I'm here, Never Let Me Go. It's not quite, I mean, obviously there's my genre allowance of deviation. If you move into sort of slightly sci-fi-ish territory, okay, you're allowed to, everyone understands how you can deviate. But over and above that, I think the portrait of England in Never Let Me Go it is a distorted mirror view of England. I'm not just referring to the central conceit that there is some sort of organ donation cloning program at large in England that everybody accepts as perfectly normal. Okay, that's the one big change, right? But that you can just say, well, that's common to all sci-fi stroke alternative history novels. But even what's left, I think, is a stylized England. It's a bleached out England. And there are certain things that happen in it that can only happen in a fictionalized, strange world.
Now, I would say that what is interesting in particular is where the novel deviates from science fiction, so that we're told immediately that the book is set in England in the late 1990s, a time when we know that no such donorship program existed. What led you to set it in a time we know when setting it in some near future, as most novelists would do, was equally possible?
I don't relish the task of having to invent all the details of a futuristic world. I mean, you know, I just the very thought of having to worry about, you know, how will cup holders pop up in 50 years' time in your car, or, you know, how do shaving mirrors work? I mean, some writers, you know, they feel their energies are really rising to the challenge. For me, it just goes clunk. You know, whereas, on the other hand, the idea of distorting a present-day, almost recognizable place for my purposes, that's something that gives me a little tingle, and that's what I want to do. You know, a familiar room where everything is slightly out of place. I mean, that appeals to me much more than a brilliantly imagined future. But of course, also, by setting it in a kind of alternative present, a wonky mirror version of England, I'd hope that some of the metaphorical reverberations of the book would come through more. And there's less chance that people think this is a warning or a prophecy, and more chance that people read it at that kind of metaphorical level. You know, we're reading this rather peculiar story, about this group of young people who are cloned, and so on. All right, so it seems like a kind of a sci-fi story, but at a certain point, I want that barrier to break down so people think, oh, I'm reading about us. I'm not reading about them anymore.
Now, it seemed to me that the subject of the book is is one that you've been concerned with before. It's about children and what happens to them unprotected under certain circumstances. That was true as well of When We Were Orphans. And it seemed to me that the book, these are, in a sense, children who've been given special treatment. They've been sent to a special school where the teachers are concerned to give them poetry, novels, have them do art. There's a sports pavilion, there's attractive grounds, there are places for their privacy. And as we read on, we realize that there are enormous numbers of other children who have not gotten to go to one of the special schools. They've simply been bred to harvest, essentially. And, you know, it's sort of as if the ghost of this book is what happens to children who are being raised for a purpose, whether that is to give up their organs or to become workers, deprived of art.
Deprived of art, did you say?
Deprived of art. Mm. You know, these are the special ones. These are the equivalents of the ones who got to go to Cambridge or Oxford. But what happens in a world where a whole generation, call them clones or call them a new generation of children, are being raised without things that their author regards as necessary for human survival.
Well, they do have art in that, you know, that's what they're encouraged to do.
I'm talking about the other schools.
Oh, the other schools. Okay.
These are special children. They've been given a special program. Shall we allow these clones to be exposed to the human concerns of art? Mm. But all the other such have been raised without it. And it sort of brings to mind the world in which we're living, in which all sorts of people think that this is icing on the cake, the liberal arts, that we can live without them, and that we can breed our underclasses to be unexposed and just expect them to exist without the things that we know make life rich.
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting analogy. I hadn't directly applied it to what you just said, but I think it's a correct analogy, and I think it's a very interesting one. What's happening here, though, with my clones, is that the kids keep asking the question, why are we being given this art to do? Why is art valuable in our community? And it does seem to be peculiarly important in their little school. Much more so than it would be even in the most kind of liberal arts orientated establishments. You know, people are bullied if they're seen to be not very creative. There's enormous pressure. It seems to be just embedded in the structure of the place. And so as they get older, after they leave this establishment, the kids ask this question, why did they make us do all this? And they realize that they have a limited lifespan. You know, that they're bred for organ donation. They don't expect to live much beyond their late 20s. So why did they spend so much of their time and energy being encouraged to create art? And they speculate about this. And I guess if there's a mystery element in the book, a lot of it is about that. I mean, the kids have various theories as to why art was given this value.
In fact, what seems so mysterious about the book is that they don't ask, why was I born? Why did they make me just to kill me? They ask, why are we doing art? It seems like the topsy-turvy version of the question that they would ordinarily ask. Why create a conscious being only to destroy that being through four donations after which they're said to be completed, although monstrously they may be conscious still and still giving donations after they've been officially completed?
Well, I mean, that same... I mean, I don't believe in God, but if there was a God, you might well ask more or less the same question to God about how he's built us.
Yes.
Yeah. We've been created to only live at most, you know, 80, 90 years, unless something comes and cuts us down earlier than that. So what is the point? You know, why do we, not just art, but why do we work? Why do we have a moral consciousness? Why do we worry about our relationships and seeking love and being loved if we're just all going to just crumble into dust anyway? I mean, who devised this? Why were we created just to die again? So just all that's happened here in this story is I've used this dystopian outline to compress what for me is a normal lifespan into a peculiarly shortened one. But all the questions I wanted these young people to ask are the questions that we all ask, and all the questions that they push to the back of their minds, like those ones that you just said. You know, so why have we been created? What, you know, should we rebel? They're the same questions I think that we push to the back of our minds. You know, we know we're mortal, but we don't spend all our time morbidly dwelling on that fact. We involve ourselves in the minutiae of our little lives. And that's some kind of, we even entertain myths about how we can ward off death by through art or through finding true love, just as these kids do.
I'm speaking with Kazuo Ishiguro. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Kazuo Ishiguro about his novel, Never Let Me Go, published by Knopf. Now, they describe their condition as being told but not told about their condition. At the school they're at, they're given enough information. One of them speculates that the information they're given is carefully dosed out at a time that they're too young to quite understand it. And so they're always knowing a little more than they can understand at any moment. So they grow into full knowledge without having assimilated that knowledge. Now, the book is constructed, I think, through these rather remarkable touches, so that the grotesque world that we might be describing will be reduced to a phrase like hooked up, to describe the intravenous procedure, or most beautifully, I think, late in the book, one of the children, Tommy, is described as having a temper and a large heart. And it took me a couple of seconds to realize that the person speaking might not be speaking of his emotions, but the size of the heart for implant. And I thought, oh my goodness, this is really something. And then there's the moment of sexuality when the narrator, Kathy, refers to his stuff. That's her word, even as relatively an adult, for his genitals. And you're feeling that the language of the book is more insinuative than direct, more revealing of the different characters and their concerns. A large heart is useful for a certain kind of implant. This is why the book, it seems to me, becomes very scary, because you're hearing a doubleness of language, both psychological and science fiction, imposed.
Well, maybe it's gone out of control a bit there. I mean, there are the words that I have. It should become clear to every reader that they've been carefully chosen as sinister euphemisms, like, you know, complete, which basically means you complete your sequence of donations and you're dead. You know, so has so and so completed yet? There is a kind of vernacular of this world that I've created that I put there very deliberately. But I guess what you've just said there alerts me to the fact that once you start that process, I guess you start to activate potentially almost any word that's in there, and people can see these a chilling kind of double entendre there. I guess it's kind of akin to when you're an adolescent and you're discovering sex for the first time, and if you wish to, you know, you can read a smutty meaning into kind of 75% of everything you read. I guess if you take the reader into a world that seems to be treacherously sinister like this, maybe that's what happens to a lot of the language.
One of the places where the children, particularly Tommy and Kathy, talk about their possibilities, Tommy tells Kathy that he thinks that the one teacher who did want them to be told more about their state, he says, I think Miss Lucy was right. And she would take him aside and try and guide him and even tell him when she'd made mistakes about his his art not being important, she's a limited knower as well, it seems. And what's more, these children have been, as we said, in a special school where they've been treated, educated, their souls have been, for better or worse, developed. But for you, is Miss Lucy right?
That's a question I've never had a clear answer to, because the real question behind that question is, I guess, you know, I tend to think we have to fool ourselves to some extent, or we have to push right to the back of our minds the fact of our mortality. It's better to kind of deceive ourselves, to give us the incentive and the motivation and the energy to have good lives. I mean, at least that's one viewpoint. And by and large, I think that's what we do. I mean, we actually admire people for having a lot of pluck and spirit. When faced with death, they manage to nevertheless push it right to the back of their minds and they get on with their lives. You know, we find that very positive. Because even when we're not threatened by terminal illness or old age, that's what we want to do. We want to live as though we're really going to, you know, we're going to live for 300, 400 years. On the other hand, you might want to say, well, it's better to, even if the answer is a bad one, it might be better to ask certain questions, try and actually think very carefully about who you are, where you are. And maybe you get a sense of dignity from answering these questions or trying to inquire about, you know, where human beings fit in, what is our condition. And I guess Tommy and Kathy, as they go through the book, they do ask these questions that the rest of the clones don't ask. And so they explore and they find out a little bit more than everybody else. And it doesn't get them any further in any practical terms. It doesn't win them any reprieves. It doesn't make them any happier. Except they have this knowledge, perhaps, that they at least try to find out who they were, and they at least found out a little bit about who they were. And whereas Ruth, some of the others, you know, they remain in relative ignorance. And maybe that's of some intrinsic value for human beings.
Well, that's very interesting, because what it makes me think of is, I've never been able to quite define it, but what you give me here, it's always seemed to me that your novels would seem to be about depressives, but in fact, they're living life as if they could sidestep their depressions, the death of their parents, their sense of rootlessness, by accepting an idealistic frame of reference. And so I'd say that this mixture, this strange combination, makes for the odd tone in the narration of these novels. They know, I think, your narrators, that they need a good long, and I mean long, cry. But they don't give themselves that option, because depression would stop them in their tracks. And so they parade on.
Yeah, I mean, depression, I don't know necessarily if I wanted to refer to clinical depression, but
no,
that things
metaphysical
are...
Metaphysical depression.
Yeah, yeah. That perception that if you looked at things too clearly, everything might seem pointless or hopeless. And so there is something to be admired in finding the courage to deceive yourself sometimes.
So you're the opposite of Beckett and Kafka, who would say that finding the system of repetition and boredoms allows one a kind of final resignation. These are characters who don't want to accept and resign. They are committed to the life process somehow.
I think they are. You know, at the end of books like The Remains of the Day, even though Stevens is an old man and his life is over. I mean, he's too late. It's too late to change himself. He can't have a second go. But he pathetically, in the final pages, that's what he's claiming he's going to do. He says he's going to try and change himself into kind of a more upbeat, casual, kind of joke-making guy for his new employer, because he's seen that the life that he's had thus far has some shortcomings, and that kind of almost hopeless courage. I think there is something admirable about that, and I think these kids have it too. In some ways, you see, I think Never Let Me Go, despite this very backdrop, is my most cheery book. You know, in that I went all out to celebrate some of the qualities of human beings, instead, rather than what I did in the past, which was to look at weaknesses and create exaggerated characters out of those weak impulses, like the fear of the emotional terrain or the tendency to servility. Rather than present kind of preemptive warnings to myself and my readers about how we could easily waste our lives despite the best intentions. This time, I guess Never Let Me Go is saying, yes, you know, everything will, we would all, to some extent, lose control of various organs and then die, yes, that. But human beings are essentially quite decent things. And here, you know, these three characters, of course, they make mistakes all the time, and they're prone to jealousy and rages and so on. But I wanted to show them trying very hard to be decent to each other. And when their time is nearly up, you know, what matters to them isn't material possessions or their status. It's whether they, you know, whether they've forgiven or been forgiven by the people dear to them, whether they've done the best they can for the people that they love.
I've been speaking with Kazuo Ishiguro, author most recently of Never Let Me Go, published by Knopf. Thank you, Ish, for joining me.
Thank you very much, Michael.
You can read an excerpt from Never Let Me Go on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
Books can be funny, too. Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're
funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com. Keyword Bookworm. Copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
When nights were bold and books, 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 books can be funny too. Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse.